League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hang in there,
dude,
it is.
That's Smiley Kaufman for 61. Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to The Smiley Show. I am Charlie Hume, and I'm, of course, alongside Smiley Kaufman once again. And we're going to pull back the curtain a little bit here. Full disclosure, we had this entire episode put to bed. Smiley was traveling cross country to prepare for his Walker on the course duties for the U.S. Open for NBC and Golf Channel. And then the ending of the Canadian Open happened. And now, of course, we're blowing up the top of the show as Smiley joins us from a car that he's taking from the airport in Los Angeles to his hotel on an iPhone to break down Nick Taylor's historic win. So, Smiley, let's start right there. It was an interesting week in the world of golf, and that was the backdrop for this tournament where Nick Taylor came down to the wire with an entire country and everyone at Oakdale seemingly rooting for him, ends up in a thriller of a four-hole playoff with Tommy Fleetwood, and makes a 72-foot bomb for eagle on the fourth playoff hole to become the first Canadian to win the National Open since 1954. So given all that context, where does this rank amongst the best finishes you've seen for a PGA Tour event?
Well, I didn't really get to watch it because I was on a flight. So I landed about probably an hour ago, and that was the first thing I saw on Twitter. I said, are you kidding me? Because when I took off, Nick Taylor had just kind of botched the 16th hole. And I'm thinking, oh, man, is he going to have a chance to win this still? And I see the 72-foot bomb, and I couldn't even believe it. And that is such a difficult putt. That green's insane. So, yeah, as far as the excitement goes, man, that the Canadian fans this past week were just incredible, man. Like, you wouldn't believe the amount of support these guys were getting all week, mainly just the Canadians. They're singing "Oh Canada" on 14T and really just, I mean, they wheeled that boy home. And then I just saw the Adam Hadwin video, too, of him getting tackled trying to spray with champagne. So there was a lot going on there, Charlie, that I missed that I would have been loved to watching live. But still, this is it's really good for the game of golf and great for Canada.
Yeah, I mean, the Hadwin video really almost overshadowed the win itself. Adam's wife, Jessica, was tweeting about the entire thing. I think I saw another tweet. There were so many flying around out there, but I think I saw one where Adam, in true Canadian fashion, apologized to the security guard after being tackled. He apologized to the security guard. If that's not the most Canadian thing that happened after a Canadian winning the Canadian Open, I don't know what is. You really could not script anything more Canadian than that. You saw the video. Let's give us a little bit of breakdown here. Like, what are your thoughts on the tackling form?
Just a nice cross check, man. I think that's the right hockey term, right? I didn't know what a Zamboni was at the start of the week, but I am pretty familiar with what a cross check is, and that seemed like it was along the lines of something that you'd see on the hockey rink versus a golf course. That's for dang sure.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you're an Alabama kid. I'm a California kid. We're not going to pretend to be hockey hardos on this podcast. But yeah, I think that you can define that as a good solid cross check there. One more kind of on the course, on the event itself. At the beginning of the week, we talked about how wonky that 18th hole was, where you're essentially asking them to hit, you know, back-to-back long irons, or sometimes even hitting less off the tee than in the second shot into that green. Did you end up loving it more, you know, simply because of the drama it created in that playoff?
Well, I kind of figured it might create some drama. I'm really of the opinion that the 18th hole, that you should have options, and it seemed that you were kind of limited with your options there at the 18th hole. So in that, I didn't really love, but I'm glad it created some drama. I figured there was a chance it might, considering that it was a very interesting par five, to say the least. Really, it was a par four when it's all said and done, probably with the scoring average ended up being. And we're going to see a lot of that this week at the U.S. Open, a lot of holes that really don't have an identity as a typical par four or par three. It's going to be really just add them up at the very end. And that's kind of what we saw at the 18th hole in Canada this week. So it's a nice look ahead to what we're going to be seeing this week at the U.S. Open and LACC.
And, you know, been a weird week in golf for a lot of different reasons. You know, for some kind of a negative week, you know, heading into a major, you know, at LACC for the U.S. Open, does this kind of feel like a good little dose of optimism, you know, something that golf fans as a whole needed to take us in, to take us out of a weird week and into one that we should be celebrating and excited for?
I think it was awesome. I think it's going to be one of the best moments we see on the PGA Tour the entire year. I don't know how you're going to really top that. You know, it's been 69 years since the last Canadian won the Canadian Open. So that was just a historic day and a great for the game of golf. But yeah, heading into the U.S. Open, it's already going to always have its juice and everybody's going to be excited. And this golf course in itself, I think, is going to be incredible. I think it's going to be awesome on TV. And I know all the guys are looking forward to getting out there and getting this week started. I'm pumped to get out there tomorrow morning.
Well, we had an emergency pod reacting to this news last week of this new entity being created between the PGA Tour, the DP World Tour, and the Saudi Public Investment Fund. And here we are doing another emergency pod late on Sunday night with you in a cab leaving the airport to react to a stunning, amazing win for Nick Taylor at the RBC Canadian Open. Really cool for the entire nation of Canada and really cool for anyone who's a golf fan. Man, it has been just a really eventful week in golf in a lot of senses of that word. We are, of course, still processing what this deal, this framework deal, entails between the PGA Tour, the DP World Tour, and the Saudi Public Investment Fund. Later in this episode, we have an interview with Matt Stoller, a really, really good interview that gave us a lot of insight on something that we're not experts in. We're golf nerds. We are not experts on antitrust and monopoly matters. Matt very much is. He publishes a really informative newsletter on the topic that centered around this deal. It's worth, you know, reading and digging into. So we have that coming up. He'll explain why he thinks this deal in its current form will not work. But Smiley, you, of course, have been boots on the ground this week up in the greater Toronto area for the RBC Canadian Open. And up there, you've spoken with a handful of players and reporters who have got a lot of nice kind of inside info on the nature of this deal, on the framework of this deal. And so I'm wondering, as the stories evolve and as you gather more information, where you stand that might be different from where we started when we were just reacting to this thing happening at the beginning of last week.
Well, I would say the players, and including myself, when all this news broke, I think there was frustration, there was confusion from the messaging, from we didn't know if we were merging with the LIV Golf Tour, is LIV still exist? And there was a lot of question marks and frustrations, and is the tour acting on our best interest? I think as the week has gone on, I've learned that actually I think the PGA Tour and Jimmy Dunn and Ed Hurley, they negotiated a pretty dang good deal.
So just to dig into that a little bit further, because of course the reporting that we read and discussed on this topic was, you know, essentially the headline there is that Jay Monahan and, you know, maybe some other, you know, players on the PGA Tour now oversee LIV Golf. And if Jay wants to disband LIV, he can. I mean, is that kind of aligned with what you've heard from the people you talked to this week?
Yeah, no, he totally can. I expect it to operate in 2024. I think 2025. In this current arrangement, I don't think LIV Golf will be around in 2025. I think that'll be the process of the players being able to come back to the PGA Tour and what are those set of circumstances. I think that it will be determined based on, you know, if you were a guy that like Brooks Koepka, who, you know, was one of the last guys to go and also didn't sue the PGA Tour. Those are two things. You got to think if you're the PGA Tour, if you got sued by one of the players, you got to think that there's going to be a set of circumstances that you might have a longer way back to get to the PGA Tour, whether that's going through Q school and working your way back up through the ranks. I don't know if some of those guys going to want to go to Q school and or go play on the Corn Ferry Tour and work your way back, but there's going to be a couple guys like I think they'd love to have Brooks Koepka back. I think he's a name that really should be on the PGA Tour. Now, whether I don't know what they're thinking, it's hard for me to speculate when it comes to that stuff, but he would be a guy that you would think, I think we're good. We might see him sooner rather than later.
You kind of outlined there the pros of the PGA Tour's current position. What about the cons that you see right now?
But I would say the business model is what I figured to be a con moving forward for the PGA Tour before they partnered up with the PIF. The $20 million purses and, you know, the PIP that they've been paying out, $100 million over the last year or two. And so I think that was definitely a con, you have to say. But based on what I heard in the financials, that the tour was in a great financial position. I don't discredit Jimmy Dunn's ability to read a balance sheet. He said that in the interview with George Savarinkas, who did a fantastic job in that interview. So, but I still think you have to mention it as a comp, because why else are you going to seek out equity just money in general? Because currently the way it's been operating, the private equity and corporate sponsors aren't exactly signing up for this $20 million deal. Now, there are tournaments that have done it, but over a long-term period of time, are they going to continue to get people and corporations and sponsors to sign up for $20 million an event? And we expect that to go up. It's not going to just stay at 20. I expect to get to more like 25. And so that is definitely one of the big things, I would say. And then potentially you might lose sponsors in this as well, because of the morality cause and the hypocrisy that the PGA Tour was standing for, being against Saudi Arabia in the PIF and all their human rights issues. So there may be companies like, you know what, we don't align with that. That's not what we see. I know that there's plenty of companies that do business with Saudi Arabia. We get our oil from them and you fill up the gas tank, but there's going to be companies that say, you know what, we're good. And so that's another thing you have to look at too, is that they may be losing some sponsors in this. I can't say that they are or they aren't, but I would probably say that would be something that the tour would be concerned with as they move forward.
If you did not listen to our episode, the interview that we had with Michael Kim coming out of that players meeting, thought it was a really, really cool insight, you know, not only into some fun stories, some light things that happened in that first sort of setting where the players got to ask Jay Monahan questions, but also, you know, this is one of the things that Michael noted, these designated events, these elevated events, the purse sizes just were not sustainable. The double wham here is that play was looking like long-term, it was not going to be sustainable to keep going back and hitting them up for $20 million every single year. And now, with the announcement of this sort of deal with the PIF, those same sponsors who you were going to go to are have morality or other issues with Saudi investment in the events. To me, the only way I can look at that and read that is that makes you heavily reliant on Saudi Arabia and the PIF going forward to fund whatever this new entity is. So that's, you know, that's definitely an interesting sort of development there. You know, specifically a lot of these sponsors kind of feeling like they were, you know, weren't looped in on this decision and kind of, you know, blindsided by it and wondering how much further they want to continue their association with the PGA Tour. Kind of going off that Michael Kim point there, the next sort of party in this that's worth examining are the PGA Tour pros themselves. Let's just kind of go right into the pros or the positions of strength that you see right now for tour pros.
Well, I had dinner with Cheston Hadley last night, and there was a viral video with him talking about, you know what, I want to be awarded for my loyalty for being on the PGA Tour. And he was kind of roasted for it on Twitter until the end of dinner, when he said, how about this, boys? PGA Tour players are going to get equity in this whole new deal. So that's got to sound pretty sweet. They're rewarded for their loyalty. And allegedly, no LIV players will be eligible for any equity in this new entity. I read that, Charlie, and I see we don't know what equity is or what percentage each player gets in the pond, you know, from the top player to the not the strongest player. We don't know what they receive in equity. We know they have a great pension with the PGA Tour. We know they get paid out every week they play on the PGA Tour and make a cut. And they've already changed so much for the positive over the last year or two, the PAC and the policy board have continued to make it more enticing for all of tour players to have a profitable experience and not feel like they're, you know, the expenses are racking up for rookies. So they're seeing a lot of different hats there, but still you don't know what you don't know at the moment. So I don't want to speculate what we think that equity might be.
To circle around on the Chess and Hadley point, what a hilarious soundbite coming out of that press conference. I hope Chesson is rewarded for his loyalty in some way, shape, or form. Chesson strikes me as the type of guy that would have made as a great range goat. Chesson, not projecting on you, if that's not the direction you would have gone, but yeah, so he stayed, and he, you know, like a lot of these other kind of, not trying to be unfair to Chesson, but a lot of the rank and file guys who make up the middle chunk of the tour. How does this look for them now that potentially these LIV guys are coming back, and what sort of cut do they get out of that? So you're exactly right. We don't know what equity looks like, but the LIV guys, if they do decide to come back, they're not eligible for that. You know, I don't know if it gets to the number that they got guaranteed for going over to LIV, but you know, if they're not eligible for that and the tour guys get that, that's definitely some form of a make good. So I think that leads us right into our next sort of con that we have listed here is how do you balance out whatever that is against what they left on the table by not going to LIV?
Well, and that's going to be continue the conversation. And I don't think we're going to have an answer to that. But what we've read is that the 20 to 30 players that had big contract offers, that the PGA Tour and Jay Monahan said that they will be well made up for and paid for their loyalty, and may make more in the end. I have a hard time believing that personally. That just seems like a bit of a stretch, because we're talking about, you know, these guys, some of them turning out hundreds and millions of dollars. It just seems, adding all that up, I don't see how you can call that even on that. But I would say the other question I have too, for if I'd probably consider this a con for some top PGA Tour players, scheduling. So we don't, with this global tour that they're talking about, let's just play hypotheticals that this global tour is going to happen and they're going to play more around the world. That's a very hot topic with top players, specifically the international players. So let's talk John Rahm, Rory McIlroy, Cameron Smith, and there's plenty of other guys that I'm sure I'm leaving out. They like playing, and for instance, Rahm loves playing in his Spanish Open. It's probably one of his favorite events to play all year. Where does that fit in? You know, is he going to be able to play the events that he wants to play? And also, like, what is he required to play in this global tour, this designated event stuff? Some of the guys, yeah, they love playing for $20 million, but the way the schedule's set up this year, guys like Rory McIlroy said, you know what, I'm done trying to play every single week here. I was wore out. I didn't like the way the schedule set up for me. And I think guys like to have control of their schedule to where they can peak for the majors. And they don't really want to just go all in on this global tour. Yeah, they love to grow the game, but they're going to be measured. These top guys are going to be measured based on how they perform in the majors and how many majors they win. And we're going to look back on how many majors Rory won, how many majors John Rahm won. And that's what we're going to remember. It's not going to be winning in Australia for this global tour. You know, I think that's a question mark for me, is it all sounds great, but what are the requirements and what are the qualifications? I think you got to look at that as a PGA Tour player that's, you know, middle of the road. Am I going to be able to get into these events? How many cards are there? Wait, the DP Tour is involved as well. Do they get spots in all this? So where's the cutoff? If I'm a guy that's sitting at 100 in the FedEx Cup right now, which typically would be in a great position on the PGA Tour, and do I have a place at the seat of this global tour, or am I going to be in the kind of the B tour? We don't know, but those are all things you have to take in.
We've kind of weaved, you know, the PIF and the DP World Tour into some of this discussion. So while they are actors in this whole situation, you know, we're not going to kind of hit on their pros and cons directly in this discussion. The next one and the final one I want to go to on this specific topic is the LIV players. And, you know, I think they did a little bit of a a victory lap, you know, on Tuesday or Wednesday. Not that I necessarily blame them for looking at an announcement that looked really good for them and saying, this is great. But they did do a little bit of a victory lap. And as more information has come out, we're not so sure where it stands for them, you know, going forward. So let's just kind of start with the pros for their side of things.
So LIV Golf, I'm going to start with just LIV Golf in general. And I think the win for them, if they, let's say they're around 10 years from now, let's say this whole thing, this merger is blocked and LIV Golf, PIF decides, you know what, since we're not a minority stake in the tour, we're going to continue to run with LIV Golf and continue to support that tour. So the pros for them is they've exposed the hypocrisy and the morality argument that the PGA Tour has made against the LIV Golf Tour and the PIF's investment in that tour. So they can continue to go after Jon Rahm. They can continue to go after the top players in the world. And now it's easier for those players to make the jump because they're not going to be scrutinized as much. Because what did Jay Monahan said? You're never going to have to apologize for being on the PGA Tour. Well, all of those morality arguments are now kind of out the door because Jay Monahan said it's okay. So now these players that are so worried about their brand and how they're perceived, they could take it, that deal, and not be scrutinized nearly as much as they would have been 2 weeks ago.
That begs the question, if the money is still there, right? And it's just so hard to figure out, you know, what everyone's motivation is in this whole scenario, including, you know, the PIF if what they really, really wanted was a seat at the table in mainstream golf and at a seat at the table with the PGA Tour and wanted to invest in that, you know, did they decide at some point, we have that access now, LIV is less of a priority for us. And so I think that kind of leads to what a potential con could be for these guys if the PIF decides they are no longer interested in supporting LIV.
Yeah, and it's, if you didn't front load your contract, so if let's say you're getting paid out over 5 to 6 years of a $120 million contract and you're set to make $20 million each year. So what happens if LIV does dissolve? Or at the time you were suing the PGA Tour, are you going to now turn around and sue the PIF if this thing goes under? I mean, I'm not one to think that sending a little letter, a subpoena, to Saudi Arabia in that mailbox, I don't think they're going to just get to that right away. I don't think, Charlie. So that's the thing that was talked about well in advance, is that if this thing goes down, are you going to really sue Saudi Arabia over your contract and think you're actually going to get paid from it? No chance.
No chance. And it's a little bit of, and again, we don't know how this is going to play out, but if it does kind of go in that direction, what they got for their efforts was a huge, well, some of them at least got a huge guaranteed paycheck. And if some of that gets, you know, spent paying fines to re-enter this newly formed entity with the PGA Tour, you know, so be it. The ironic part of this whole thing to me is when all these guys left for LIV and the tour kind of made their own sort of changes and increased purses, but didn't do anything guaranteed, the line that kept being tried out was just play better and you know, you'll make the money and you'll eventually come out ahead. And it's looking now like that line might best apply to the guys who went to LIV who didn't get the guaranteed contracts. Like, I can't imagine like a Brandon Grace, you know, got that much money up front to go play, but he wins a couple of events, he wins some team stuff, and he makes a little nice chunk of money. There are other guys on that tour, right, who maybe didn't get that guaranteed money, didn't win or play well. And if they're hung out to dry, how much of that chunk is actually going to clear when they do all the work to get back to the PGA Tour?
That's a huge question. And I think there's going to be winners and losers of the LIV Golf Tour. And I think the players that'll be winners are the ones that got the big contracts that can afford to pay the penalties. But over a long period of time, when we're talking about maybe the top players on the PGA Tour that are getting a higher equity stake in this new entity, they may net profit more over the LIV Golf Tours. Let's say you earn a $100 million contract to play for LIV Golf Tour, and the PGA Tour said, you know what, we'll let you come back for $30 million fine. That just sounds ridiculous to say, but we're just kind of using ballpark easy numbers. Who knows what these guys are going to make in equity on the PGA Tour? We don't know, but we can definitely look at the losers like you're talking about on the LIV Golf Tour. So middle of the road guys that went over to the LIV Golf Tour from the PGA Tour. So let's just use someone like Cameron Tringali as an example. I love Cameron Tringali. I think he's a great player, but let's just use him there. And the fact that, okay, he probably didn't get any upfront money and he was probably banking on this thing going, and I'm going to make a bunch of money over here and I'm not probably ever going to play the PGA Tour again. Probably felt comfortable saying I'm not going to ever play another PGA Tour event. So let's say LIV Golf dissolves and Cameron Tringali has to pay a penalty that's more than what he made on the LIV Golf Tour. That would be considered a losing situation. But Brooks Koepka, $100 million deal, like just he's probably like, whatever you want me to pay, and I'll be back on the PGA Tour. And I got my brother made a bunch of money. Now I'm doing well and playing well in majors, and that's really all I've really cared about. So a lot of different ways to slice it up when it comes to who won and who didn't win on the LIV Golf Tour. We really don't know, but it's just a wait and see there.
So many angles on the story. This thing continues to develop. There is a new article out every day with new information and a new way to break it down. So we will continue to do that as best we can as we get more information. You can find some of the recaps we did last week if you go back to the Smiley Show feed right now, wherever you get your podcast. But we've spent enough time doing our own amateur business analysis of this topic. And you know, I think we did a pretty solid job. But we now have Matt Stoller coming up, and Matt is going to give us really a nice thorough breakdown of the deal as it stood or as it stands and why he'd have concerns about this thing going through. So let's get right to our interview with Matt Stoller.
We're joined now by Matt Stoller, who wrote a book called Goliath on the topic of monopolies. Also writes a monopoly-focused newsletter called Big. You can find it at thebignewsletter.com and recently published an informative piece on the PGA Tour PIF deal. Matt, thank you for joining us. And I'm going to get started with this headline. The Saudi PGA Tour golf deal isn't going to happen. For our listeners who are more familiar with golf and less familiar with the politics of monopoly power like me, can you summarize why, in your opinion, this deal will not happen?
Yeah. So we have laws in this country called antitrust laws that are, I don't know, about 150 years old or so, 130, 40 years old, that say that you're not allowed to create a monopoly, right? And you're not allowed to, if you're a monopoly, you're not allowed to maintain it by excluding your competitors from the market. And LIV Golf and the PGA Tour have actually been suing each other over monopolization using these laws for about a year or two. And this merger is very clearly a violation of the antitrust laws, right? Because there's one of the laws called the Clayton Act. And the Clayton Act says that mergers that may substantially lessen competition or tend to create a monopoly are illegal. The head of the PGA Tour comes out and says, we're doing this to take out a competitor. It's great. And every antitrust lawyer that I know was like, this, what is he doing? Like, if you're doing something illegal, you're supposed to at least pretend you're not doing the thing, right? And he just comes out and says it. And he's so, like, every antitrust lawyer that I know was like, this is crazy. Like, this is clearly going to get challenged because it's not just that he came out and he said, yeah, we're doing the crime. It's also that there were two competitors that were competing vigorously. They were bidding for, like, their prize money was going up to bid for the players. And now there's going to be one. So 2-1, right? Like, that's, like, really easy to understand. And also the PGA Tour was already under a Department of Justice investigation for antitrust violations for what they were doing to keep the new golf league out of the market. So this is, like, I have never seen a deal like this. And I'm kind of sit on the left. So, you know, my politics, I kind of sit on the left and I'm like, we need more enforcement of antitrust and big corporations have too much power, that kind of thing. But, like, I know a lot of lawyers across, I'm not a lawyer, but I know a lot of, like, antitrust lawyers who are on the right, who are in the center, who work for big business, who don't work for big business, that kind of thing. There's, like, a consensus that this deal is, like, crazy. It's so crazy that apparently the PGA Tour and LIV Golf, when they were cutting this deal, did not talk to an antitrust lawyer about it, which is insane, right? Like, it's like, I don't know how to explain it. Every deal of any of a reasonable size has an antitrust. You could just ask an antitrust lawyer, say, is this a problem? And they will tell you yes or no. And they didn't talk to one. And that is like nuts, right? That's just crazy. So this deal is not going through.
I saw some reporting specifically on that piece about antitrust lawyers being involved. That would not align at all with the litigation that preceded this deal. You know, essentially, right, one of the reasons why they did the deal was to end that ongoing antitrust litigation. So is that, like, does that even seem plausible to you? Or do you think something else is at play here?
I think this is such a weird deal. I don't think this deal is intended to be completed. I don't like conspiracy theories, but this is too strange. Like, why would the PGA Tour and the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, these are sophisticated actors, and they have a lot of antitrust lawyers on payroll fighting each other. I don't know why they would be so obviously clumsy here and announce something like this and just openly say this is taking a competitor off the table. That doesn't make any sense to me. To me, this looks like something else is going on. I don't know what that is, but this is just too weird. This is just too weird to be like, oh, they figured it out, like, and they're just going to merge, and now they trust each other. Like, I think, like, one of the things that happened in the litigation between LIV Golf and PGA Tour, and I'm not a golf person, so if I screw up some of the terminology, like, sorry, but like, one of the things that happened is they were going into a phase called discovery, which is when you go and you find all of the, like, you look in their emails and you can, like, bring that stuff to trial. And the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund was saying, hey, you can't do discovery on us because we're a nation state. And there are certain, like, legal rights that a nation state has that normal people and corporations don't have. And a judge said, and it would be like the kind of thing where it's like, if a nation is like buying something for a military base or doing something like nation-y, like they're you're not allowed to like sue them. There's certain doctrines that like make it give them rights that corporations and ordinary people don't have. Well, in this case, a judge said, well, yeah, you're a nation state, but you're trying to run a golf league. So there's like a commercial exception. You have to hand over emails. And so now the Saudi government, right, this autocratic, very secretive government has to hand over like a ton of emails and internal documents about the way they're thinking about spending all their oil money. And then this deal comes and all of a sudden the case goes away right before all this stuff was supposed to become public. And that seems like a pretty good reason for like why you would announce this kind of deal, even if it falls apart later, right? But I don't know who, you know, speculating on these things a little bit like, it's what I put in my piece, but it's a little bit like looking at ripples in the ocean and trying to figure out what's underneath, right? Because you never know, especially when it has to do with like the Saudis and like, you know, the weird global sports leagues, which are, as you guys know, like super corrupt. And like, you know, Donald Trump is vaguely involved. Like, it's weird. This is like a weird thing going on here. And I think everybody knows that.
Well, let's say it is a game of chess. Let's say they know this isn't going to go through and they've tried to position themselves to be in the best situation as they move forward, whether they're with each other or against each other. And the tour took a very high moral ground on this the entire time. And what it exposed was a hypocrisy at the very end of this. Now that these two guys have been shouting at each other, now they're sitting next to each other on CNBC. Let's say it does go away and they still operate as a PGA Tour and LIV. What it has done for me is that the players now, it's easier for them now to make that jump to LIV Golf if this were to go away.
I guess I'll just start by saying, like, you know, you say you look, you were like, there, someone's playing chess here, and all the reporters were like, you know, saying, oh, this merger, it's like a victory for the Saudis and all this. And one possibility, and like we're used to thinking about like people with a lot of capital and power as knowing what they're doing. In my experience, some of them do know what they're doing, but many of them are just like entitled rich idiots. So it's also possible that this is just, you know, just a mess, right? And they're just idiots who maybe they were like negotiating this and it was in the middle of the negotiations, it was about to leak and they just panicked, right? That could be one thing, right? Who knows? I love the moral hypocrisy kind of thing is like, I find that sort of amusing because it's like, you know, like, come on, it's Saudi Arabia, right? We like bought, like they provide oil to everyone. Like, let's just be honest. Like we fund a lot of authoritarian states. Like this whole notion of like, oh, you know, of it's just like morally exhausting, right? I mean, the golfers should just look at themselves as business people and just say, I sell golfing services. I'm going to sell it to the highest bidder, the end. And if we want to do something about Saudi Arabia, then the US government should do that. Why are we asking a bunch of golfers to act like the US government or the PGA Tour to act like the US government? Like, this is embarrassing and stupid. We got a problem with Saudi Arabia, which we obviously don't, then we should act through our government to do something. Like, I don't know, that's the way I feel about it. I am tired of this, like the US is the global democracy beacon type of thing. And yet like everyone knows that we there's really great things about America. Like, and I love America. And I think a lot of the things that we do are awesome, but it's just really irritating that we have to pretend like we only deal with good people, right? Like that's just silly. It's just a silly notion. It's totally outside of like the bounds of American history. It's this very strange post 1991 thing where America was the dominant power and you didn't have to pay attention to anyone else. So anyway, I just think it's weird that we're asking the PGA Tour and golfers to act like the US government because they're not.
Here, we're trying to avoid hypotheticals. If you'll allow me to just create a hypothetical situation here for you. Let's say this new joint entity calls you tomorrow. It says, Matt, we got this thing wrong. We rushed it. We clearly did not see all these antitrust issues. How would you, if you were taking this deal in its current state, restructure it to avoid those issues and potentially make it legal? And do you even see a path to that as it currently is set up?
So I'll say what I think will happen. And I don't know, because there's a lot here that is sort of mysterious. I think that this deal will fall apart in 6 months to a year, and the Saudis will shut down Loop Golf, and then they will put some money into the PGA Tour at some point later. That's my guess as to what happens. I think they want, for a variety of reasons, they want to save themselves a bunch of embarrassment, and then they have made a power play. They will then blame shutting down Live Golf on the antitrust division. So, oh, you mean U.S. government? You made this unprofitable. Like, that's what they're going to do. Not, we knew we were violating the law. Not knowing anything about the PGA Tour, but I do know something about how monopolists tend to think. They usually have a lot of restrictive contracts. So if you want to, you know, if you want to play in the tour, you want to be a supplier to the tour, you want to be a broadcaster in the tour, you have to do XYZD. You can't let in rivals. You can't play at different tournaments that we don't, you know, tournaments have certain like time restrictions or distance restrictions. Like, I would just say, okay, we will do this merger, but we'll get rid of all that stuff. So we'll allow for new leagues to like enter. We'll allow for new independent tournaments, that kind of thing. I don't think it'll work because like the antitrust division is run. Like one of the things that's happening here is that in the 19, like a lot of people are asking, why didn't people do anything about the PGA Tour? It's been a monopoly for a long time. And it's a good question. And the answer is because we really didn't, you know, we stopped caring about monopolies in this country from the early 1980s up until the financial crisis of 2008. And gradually since 2008, 9, 10, there's been increasing discourse about the problem of too big to fail. And people have said, wait a second, it's not just banking, it's also like big tech, right? Like Google and Facebook and Amazon, they're too powerful. We like them, but like they have too much power. Oh, also like, it seems like medicine is way too expensive. And all of these things are, oh, wait a second, we have a bunch of shortages. It seems like, oh, wow, we have semiconductor issues. Like people have started to realize, okay, we have a series of monopoly problems throughout the economy. And, you know, you saw with the, like the NCAA, the sports, you know, the NIL, like I've reported on antitrust problems in the mixed martial arts, right? It's big antitrust suit there. There's actually an antitrust, a whole bunch of antitrust problems in cheerleading, like all-star high school cheerleading. Like monopolization is a systemic feature of the American economy, and it's a systemic feature of sports because sports are part of the American economy. And so the Biden administration, so first the Trump administration brought an antitrust suit against Google in 2020, which is the first major monopolization case in 20 years since the Microsoft suit. And then the Biden administration appointed very aggressive enforcers. One of them is a guy named Jonathan Cantor, who's at the antitrust division. So he'll be running point on the PGA Tour thing. And then the other one is Lina Khan at the Federal Trade Commission. And they've done a lot of really aggressive new moves to stop monopolization. So if you look at like on Wall Street, the number of mergers and acquisitions has dropped by about 60 or 70% this year to last year. Some of that is because of higher, like tighter financing costs, but a lot of that is because of the policy changes to make mergers harder. So right now, what's going on with the PGA Tour and LIV Golf is they're going to run straight into this buzzsaw of more aggressive enforcement because people noticed like monopolization is bad. And if you went back 20 years or 30 years, people wouldn't be concerned about it the way that they are now. So one of the things that we were talking about off air is that Congress is super mad at the golf leagues, right? And they're upset about the nonprofit extent. Part of that has to do with like Saudis and this human rights thing. But part of it has to do with the fact, like 30 years ago, when there was investigations of the PGA Tour, antitrust investigations, Congress got mad at the investigators and said, stop doing it because, you know, you're bothering a bunch of like people that are our friends.
The public investment fund isn't actually invested any money in the PGA Tour. What they have is the right of first refusal. So does that change anything about the perception of the legality of this deal at all to you?
One of the things that's weird about this deal is they came out, they said, this is a great merger. And then like, they were like, oh, it's not a merger. Actually, we're creating a new, you know, and like nobody knows it's an alliance or it's a framework or whatever, right? And the specific procedural elements might be different, but it doesn't actually matter what the legal form is. If it's reducing competition in a meaningful way, there's an antitrust problem. So the Department of Justice just won an antitrust suit against two airlines. So American Airlines and JetBlue have what's called an alliance in the Northeast. So Boston and New York, if you're flying to or from Boston and New York and you buy through JetBlue or American Airlines, they have essentially integrated their operations in the Northeast hub through this Northeast alliance. And the DOJ went after that and said, this basically is quasi equivalent to a merger, and it's reducing competition because those two companies were vigorously competing and now they're not. And they just won because, and the judge said, look, this looks like a merger. It economically functions like a merger. It's illegal. So they might, you know, they may not file the form saying where this is a merger. They may try to avoid, they may try to say, oh, this isn't a merger. This isn't actually like, you know, do like this doesn't maybe violate the Clayton Act or, you know, they could play like cute games. But the truth is, you know, when the head of the PGA Tour comes out and says, this is great, we're getting rid of a competitor, you can't hide that. Like he said that. And I can only imagine when the DOJ goes into the, first of all, there's a bunch of stuff already public in the antitrust like suit filings between the two golf leagues. But like, if he's saying that publicly, what are they saying privately? Like, this is just going to be like discovery for the DOJ. It's like going to be hilarious. Right. I mean, like what? I don't know how you could. I mean, that is the kind of thing when you say publicly, it's like if you are private, if you're looking through email and you find that, you're like, oh, my gosh, this is going to be like the centerpiece of our complaint, because like a complaint is basically a story to the court. You say, Mr. Judge, you know, I believe that this, you know, and you usually put a quote up top that's like really compelling, and that they already just publicly gave that quote. Right. I don't know how it could get worse privately, but I'm sure it's worse.
Well,
Matt, this is all fascinating, and we'll wrap up there. And I think we have a better understanding of antitrust laws, monopolies. I wish that you could have walked me through my economy class at LSU, because I needed a lot of help in economics when I was in college. And this was all really good stuff. And I feel like we got this whole PIF PGA tour deal. We're still trying to figure it out every single day. And you definitely helped bring some insight when it comes to the antitrust, the Department of Justice, all the things, the parallels and different examples you gave were fantastic. And we look forward to keeping up with you on check out the newsletter as well at BIG at thebignewsletter.com. And Matt, thank you again for coming on. This was awesome.
Hey, thanks. And can I just say one thing about—
Absolutely.
So one of my favorite congressmen who, you know, he died in 1976, but he said, it's really important to study economics so that you can know when economists are lying to you.
Well, I'm just going to take your word for it, man.
Yeah.
that's how I got through school. I was like, you know what? If they said I was good enough, I got through. That was me. But I'm going to take your word for it, Matt. Thank you again for coming on.
Talk to you guys later.
Well, Smiley, it seems a little crazy, given everything that's going on in golf, to look at the calendar and realize we have a major coming up this week. The third major of the season, the U.S. Open at Los Angeles Country Club, the North Course. Really excited to kind of break a little bit down about the architecture of that course and some changes that have been made. There are a lot of people that are really pumped about this in the golf world. But before we get to that, just want to kind of run the Smiley highlight reel back, look back in the files, some experience you had at the U.S. Open. You played in two of these things.
Just two miscuts. All good.
I'm not saying it. yeah, so you played at Pinehurst number 2 in 2014, just down the road from me here in North Carolina. And you also played at Oakmont in 2016. So what were your memories of the way those events were set up, those courses, any good stories that you have to share?
Yeah, well, the Pinehurst number 2 was my first start as a professional. I'd just gotten out at LSU, made it through local qualifying and then sectional qualifying. And then, cause I was thinking about just staying amateur for that summer because I was playing so well. I really felt like I could have a big summer in the amateur circuit to potentially play your way on to a Walker Cup or a Palmer Cup. I don't know what it was that year, and made it through. So I was like, all right, well, that was easy. I'm going to turn pro, because if I make the cut, I definitely want to make some money at the U.S. Open to get a jump start on professional golf. And the week was awesome. I had my brother, Lucky, caddying for me. And it's a great story. So we showed up on Sunday, and we played 18 holes on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And just because—
For what reason?
We were just so pumped to be there. I was so pumped. I just had to make sure that I was ready. And by the time Thursday came around, I was gassed. I mean, I've just played so much golf and it was hot, but it was so much fun. I wanted to be out there playing 18 holes every day. And the yardage books that you get as a pro, my brother and I were using it all week to try to figure out, you know, all the things that you need to know as a pro, just reading a yardage book. And there's bold numbers in a yardage book that you look at that represent a front number. So when you see a bold number, it means 100. If it says 146 bold, that's to the front. And my brother and I thought that was to the middle of the green. So it took us till Wednesday to figure out that, oh, so why are we long on every single shot? I mean, you've been talking about just dumb and dumber out there trying to figure out our way in pro golf. And well, we got it figured out going into Thursday. And actually it was paired with Maverick McNeely. He was a freshman at Stanford at the time. So it was fun getting paired with him. And man, we had a great time. I missed the cut, played well. I played okay. And you know, was kind of right on that cut line and just didn't get it through. But on to Oakmont. There was a rain-soaked week. If anybody ever asked me, what's the hardest golf course you've ever played, it's probably Oakmont. And it was soft Oakmont. It still was hard. And it's just, the place is ridiculous. it's always ready to host a US Open. Doesn't matter the week. It's just ridiculously hard. I think I missed the cut by one or two. Didn't have my best stuff. I hit a shank in the tournament. So that was fun.
Just going back to Pinehurst number two briefly. I listen, I love golf as much as the next, you know, golf addict. I don't know that I can think of a more brutal reality than playing a US Open setup, potentially playing a US Open setup for 8 days in a row. Playing it 6 days in a row is more than enough. But on top of that, playing four of those days with an incorrect yardage book. That's a truly incredible story.
Yeah, it was good. I want to say that Lucky was probably shooting a lot of it with a rangefinder all week. And I think he was like cross-checking his rangefinder numbers with the numbers that he had in the book. But most of the time in practice rounds, the pins are normally in the dead middle of the green. So it would probably add up to him to think, oh yeah, that's definitely that bold number is definitely in the middle. So yeah, that checks, that math checks out.
That checks. That's amazing. Well, cool to hear about, you know, the times you've got in the courses really you've got to play. And we have another really, really cool one coming up this week, Los Angeles Country Club, the North Course. Fried Egg did as the Fried Egg does a wonderful sort of course preview on this, talking to, you know, the people involved with the restoration of this course and taking it back to its George Thomas roots. And, you know, George Thomas, of course, famous for three courses in the Los Angeles area, Bel Air, Riviera, and LACC. And this was his home club. So I'm just curious, Smiley, like anything that pops for you in terms of the golf course itself this week, of the type of player it might suit, things you're excited to see.
If Brooks Koepka plays well, I don't think anybody can beat him.
Wow.
Yeah. I think what I see in this golf course is just right up his alley. It seems like you're going to be able to hit a lot of drivers, and I would be shocked to not see Brooks Koepka near the top of the leaderboard come the last nine holes on Sunday. You know what I mean, Charlie? Would you be surprised?
You know what? Honestly, nothing is going to surprise me with Brooks going forward, because we knew him as the major whisperer. Then he had those catastrophic sort of that gruesome injury, and honestly we didn't really know a ton about that. So I think in golf it's tough to know, is this person losing form, are they injured, are they past it? And so the way he's kind of burst back onto the scene this year, I would not rule him out at all, and neither will the odds makers. I mean, he's third on the board at 11-1 behind only John Rahm at 9-1 and Scottie Scheffler at 7-1. Just to kind of put a pin in the whole the course thing, you know, Gil Hance, you know, and Jeff Shackelford worked with him on this restoration as well too, because he was almost like a historian that provided Gil guidance as he was trying to figure out how to you know take this thing back to its Thomas roots. It just got that, I don't know how to describe it or say it other than it just got that Gil Hance look. Like, he did such a good job at making these courses feel classic again, and I'm looking forward to, as Gil laid out, that the 6, 7, 8 stretch is going to be a really, really cool stretch, where 6 is this little short par 4, like 325 yards, but it's kind of a blind shot downhill. The fairway kind of goes out downhill, and then it hard snaps at the end, so the green's kind of tucked back to the right, mm-hmm. and there's a tree in front of it. So, you know, I'm sure there are guys. It looks it. I mean, I've never played it, but it looks like a really, really cool little setup there. And then you go right into the seventh hole, which is one of these George Thomas, you know, par 3, par 4 hybrid holes that's going to be played as a 284-yard par 3 for the U.S. Open, which just seems insane to me. And then you have a par 5 on the 8th. And the feature of all those three holes is that signature Barranca that kind of cuts across all three.
Which was restored. Those are restored Barrancas from Gil Hands and his team. And it plays all the way through LACC, and it's going to be a great feature. I'm sure that NBC Sports, we're going to have some awesome just like drone shots just flying through those Barrancas that are just going to be so sick to watch on TV.
We talked a little bit about Brooks, going right into kind of some of the favorites. You know, we also noted Scotty and John Rahm as well. Another guy in that group of favorites, because the list of players that are shorter than 25-1 right now are Scotty, Rahm, Brooks, Rory at 12-1, Cantlay at 14-1, Victor Hovland at 16-1, and Xander Schauffele at 18-1. I want to ask you about Hovland, because you've said on this podcast, you're really loving the way he's playing right now. And I know this golf course is a lot of people are going to make the comparisons to Riviera because they're both in LA and they're both George Thomas courses. You know, it's not the exact same, but it's our closest reference point. So Victor had a T5 there in 2021, a T4 in 2022. Could this be Victor's week?
It very well could be. He's playing like a top five player in the world. So he's definitely not a guy to discredit. I look for hype in the greens. I think that's going to be a huge metric that always plays well at major championships. But when you talk about firm fairways, which I expect to see most of the time, it's a little bit more difficult to get that height coming into greens, especially firmer greens. So, you know, that points to Scotty, Rory and guys like that, that can kind of get the ball up in the air. But, you know, it's hard for me to not think about a guy that's played really well at Riviera, and are these direct matches on if you play well at Riviera, you're going to play well at LACC? Probably not. But a guy that nobody really is talking about at all, that if he just starts to find his game a little bit and kind of get into some form, is Dustin Johnson. Doesn't that guy just sound like he's going to play good at LACC? You know,
I absolutely agree with you. He is 35-1 right now on the board. That's a whole another interesting collection of guys that live contingent, where you have Cam Smith at 30-1, DJ at 35-1, Bryson at 40-1, Joaquin Neiman, who won at Riviera in 2022 at 75-1, and then Phil Mickelson at 151. There are others, but those are just the notables we've listed. DJ, for me, I mean, this is a guy who has obviously, you know, played well in U.S. Opens. He won at Oakmont. The profile you're creating is a guy who can hit the ball, you know, with Brooks and DJ. Can hit the ball long, can hit the ball straight. If the greens get firm and get tricky, a guy who's kind of been in those situations and won and isn't going to let, you know, one bad score or one sort of aberration throw him off a little bit. Guy can keep his cool. I think DJ is a great call.
Yeah, I think so. And I would think that this is going to be, you know, you're going to have to drive it well to be able to score, but not like past US Opens, which makes me think, okay, if you just drive it pretty good, it's going to be a second shot golf course. So who are the guys that can control their ball flight, hit it high, kind of be able to shape it a little bit both ways to get to some different hole locations? So there's plenty of guys that are able to do that. And I'm looking forward to seeing what it looks like, because I may change my opinion on this after I see it again, because I played it and I remember thinking, yeah, it's really hard. But in my head, I just see a lot of guys being able to play well here.
Some names that I just want to kind of throw at you and see if any of these guys pop for you. Matt Fitzpatrick, 25-1, who is the defending U.S. Open champ. Cole Morikawa, 25-1, who again has had some success at Riviera in the last couple of years. Tony Finau at 30-1, who's played, you know, some good West Coast golf. Max Homa at 30-1, a guy who, you know, for a lot of people a couple months ago was saying this guy's an absolute lock. You might as well just etch his name on the trophy right now. He's going to run away with it. And at 30-1, to me, that seems like a really good number. And then Cam Young at 35-1, who also has had success at Riviera. Again, I know that doesn't mean he's going to play well here, but just as a reference point. So Fitzpatrick, Morikawa, Finau, Homa, Cam Young, anyone there that really pops for you?
Yeah, Tony Finau. He's his approach to the green metrics this year have been very good. I think if he's not at the top in approach to the green with his irons, he's very well close to it. He's hit a lot more fairways from what I've seen this year, teeing the ball down low, just to make sure he finds the fairway. And maybe he doesn't have to do that quite as much at LACC. But he does have that little tee down shot, put a little more spin on the drive to make sure he can hold the fairways to utilize how good of an iron player he is. And if Tony Finau is going to win, if he's going to win the U.S. Open, it's all going to be about the putter for him. He's got that hands real low, that toe up in the air, and his putting stats have been pretty decent compared to where he's been in the last year or two. And that's, for him, is going to be something that's probably going to be the thing that gets him over the top, is how good of a putting week he has.
Well, I feel like it's a pretty good synopsis of the course, the guys who could be in the hunt. As you mentioned, you are going to be boots on the ground out there this whole week. I'm insanely jealous. I'll be watching from afar here in my attic. But what are you most looking forward to this week about just being on the property, and maybe kind of tell us Is there anything we can look forward to in terms of, you know, stuff you're going to be doing, the way you're going to be covering, you know, this major, and where we can kind of find you as part of the coverage for both Golf Channel and NBC?
Yeah, Walker for the main team for the NBC. So I'll be out there Thursday to Sunday, watching some players try to win that U.S. Open, and it's gonna be a long week. I expect the hours to be pretty grinding for the Walker, but I'm pumped to be out there. I'll do 80 holes a day if they let me. It's just gonna be the place to be is gonna be LACC next week, and I can't imagine not being out there. It's gonna be epic, the amount of celebrities that are gonna be out there, athletes. It's gonna be fun running in and seeing people where I'm inside the ropes. I'm like, oh my God, I know that guy. Like, it's gonna be so sick. The venue is gonna be awesome. I think it's one that people have been looking forward to for a long time, and I'm excited to get back with the NBC team. It's, you know, we haven't been together since San Antonio, so it feels like a long time now, where we hadn't had our full team together. So looking forward to calling some golf on late Saturday and Sunday, which I haven't done in a while. So I'm looking forward to seeing who's going to get this thing done. That's all for us this week on The Smiley Show. We will continue to provide updates on the ongoing deal between the PGA Tour, the DP World Tour, and the Public Investment Fund. So make sure you're subscribed to the feed so you can download these episodes when they drop. Thanks for listening, and we will see you back here on Thursday. The Smiley Show is part of the SiriusXM Sports Podcast Network. If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, please give a 5-star rating and leave a review. Subscribe today wherever you stream your podcast.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar plant protein bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQBars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.